Truths for today. Tonight we're talking about the state. What the Bible has to say about the state and the relationship of Christians to the state and the relationship of churches to the state. I want tonight to make 5 points. The first is this. The state is instituted by God. The state is instituted by God. It is God who has decreed that there should be government, that there should be authorities. We read earlier from Romans chapter 13, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. It is God who has instituted authority in general. It is God who has decreed that within this world, some people will be in positions of authority. And it is God who overrules who rises into those positions of authority. It is God who raises some up and God who casts others down. That's Paul in Romans. Peter says much the same thing in his first letter, 1 Peter and chapter 2. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as the supreme authority, or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. The authorities that exist are instituted by God. Anarchy is not a Christian ideal. There are those who say, wouldn't it be wonderful if we didn't have government? They say they see so much that governments do, which is wicked and corrupt, and they say, oh, if only we could get rid of all the governments. But that is not what the Bible says. The Bible says that government is necessary. God has decreed that there should be government, that there should be authorities, that there should be legislatures, that there should be justice systems, that there should be police forces, that there should be ways of making law and enforcing law, that there should be ways of ruling countries. God himself has instituted government. And we would say that it is better to have some government than no government. Everywhere, in every country, governments do arise. Anarchy never happens in the end. In the end, where you have people living together, it will always happen that some become influential and that some control others. There will always be people who rise into positions of authority. And it is important then that there should be structures so it put in place so that those who are in authority should use their authority properly and discreetly, that they should use their authority in legitimate ways and not illegitimate ways, that there should be checks and balances between the different types of authority that exist. All of that is planned, ordained by God. The second thing I want to say is this, that the state, the authorities, are authorized by God for two purposes chiefly. Firstly, the state is authorized by God to punish crime. That is the first great role that the state must play. This again is what Paul says. The rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. The one who is in authority is God's servant to do you good, But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. That is the primary and chief role of the person who is in authority. That is the primary role for which the government and the state exists, to punish wrongdoers, to prevent people from carrying out criminal, brutal, unjust actions against each other. This goes back to very nearly the beginning of human history. You'll remember that that Adam and Eve's son, Cain, became a murderer. He killed his brother Abel, but he was never punished for it. He was allowed to live. He was allowed to go out and go his own way. He was allowed to build a city in which he would, in which he could do things just as he wanted. The Lord indeed put a mark on him so that others would not attack him and assault him. He was allowed, in one sense, to get away with his crime here on earth. And what happened? Well, the community that grew up around Cain became an increasingly violent community. One of Cain's descendants was a man called Lamech. And when you read Genesis chapter 4, you see what a brutal man Lamech was. And you see what a violent society developed around him. Lamech said to his wives, this is Genesis 4:23, Ada and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I've killed a man for wounding me. I've killed a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. Lamech is boasting. He says, a lad, a mere lad, dared to touch me. I killed him. Anybody who touches me, I'll have vengeance on him. And I'll have it 77 times over. That was the sort of society that Cain's descendants developed. A society in which the weak went to the wall and the strong took vengeance into their own hands, and in which the most brutal things were done. And what was the result of it? Well, within a very short space of time, we read this, Genesis chapter 6. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thought of his heart was evil all the time. Genesis 6:11, now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. The whole of society degenerated into brutality and cruelty and violence, in which the strongest could oppress the weakest, in which people could slaughter one another with impunity. And that was why God had to send the flood. A society in which there was no government, a society in which there were no laws, a society in which there was no justice system, became a society full of violence, a society in which it was impossible to live any sort of civilized, stable life. A society in which everybody lived in fear. A society that was so horrible in God's sight that God had to obliterate it and wash it off the face of the earth. And so what did God say? When that washing clean was complete, when the great flood had come and gone, when Noah and his sons emerged from the ark, God said this. Genesis chapter 9 verse 5. For your lifeblood I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal. And from each man too I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it. God says, I am laying down a law which must be enforced on earth. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. There has to be a system which brings justice to the murderer. There has to be a system put in place so that the world never reaches the state again that it was in before the flood. There have to be some ways of preventing anarchy and violence from occurring on that scale again. A man who commits murder, there has to be a system for tracing him. There has to be a system for proving that he's done it. There has to be a system for convicting him. There has to be a system for punishing him. There has to be a system for executing him. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. That was the original institution of government by God. Up till this point, we've never read of any government upon the earth at all. But now God says there has to be some sort of government to bring law and order, to control the wicked, to punish the murderer. And then as you go on through the Bible, you see that it's not just murder that has to be dealt with and punished, but every other crime that one man commits against another. Every way in which one man damages another who's made in the image of God. It's the role of the state to ensure that people cannot harm one another and get away with it. That is the first purpose for which God instituted the state. But then there is a second purpose as well. And it's hinted at in different places. You can think of Jesus' debate with a group of people who came to him. There were people who came to Jesus to tempt him, to test him by difficult questions. And they included some Herodians and some Pharisees. These were people who had different attitudes to government. The Herodians thought that the Romans were the best thing since sliced bread. The Herodians were right behind the Roman governors in the land of Israel. Whereas the Pharisees wanted as little to do with the Roman authorities as possible. And so these Pharisees and Herodians come to Jesus to question him. And they say this, it's in Mark chapter 12 and verse 14. Teacher, we know that you're a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. But you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we? But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. Why are you trying to trap me, he asked. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. Denarius was a coin, a Roman coin. And they brought the coin. They found one straight away. This was the coinage they used. This was the coinage they used for their own business transactions. So they were able to bring him a coin. And he asked them, whose portrait is this? Whose inscription is on the coin? And they said, Caesar's. And then Jesus said to them, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Do you see the point that Jesus is making there by calling for that denarius? Those people all wanted to be part of a society where there would be a stable currency, where they could carry on trading, buying, selling, doing business. That was only made possible because Caesar underwrote the value of coins. It was only made possible because Caesar, the authorities, the state, brought some sort of economic stability. John, will you go through to your mum, please? Now. Excuse me. I am embarrassed to have to do that. Caesar was the one who used his authority to give his empire a stable currency. It wasn't just that he punished criminals, it's that he enabled life to go on normally. He enabled people to live a stable existence, even in financial terms. That's why Jesus says it's right to pay your taxes. That's something you owe to him. He deserves his cut of the prosperity that he's made possible. You think of Paul's words when he writes to Timothy, and he says this: I urge that requests, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceable and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. He says that's what authorities are supposed to do. They're supposed to make it possible for people to live peaceful and quiet lives, stable lives. He's not just talking about freedom from crime. He's talking about all those things that go to make up a peaceable, quiet society. All those things that make it possible just for life to go on. He's talking about safe roads. And he's talking about stable currency, yes. And he's talking about protection from invaders. And he's talking about dustbins being emptied. If those things stop happening, then you no longer have a peaceable and quiet life. You have an unhygienic life. You have a disorganized life. In order for people just to live in peace, you need government to guarantee all the ordinary structures of life. And that is what government is authorized by God to do. On the one side, the state is authorized to punish crime. And on the other side, the state is authorized to do those things that are necessary to keep society stable, to make it possible for people to live peaceable and quiet lives. And then my third point is this, that churches and believers must honor and submit to the authority of the state, while it restricts itself to those God-given roles. Believers and churches must honor the authority of the state, and they must submit to the authority of the state, while the state restricts itself to the roles that God has given it. That's clearly what Paul says in the passage we read, Romans chapter 13, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities. He talks about what the authority of the state is. He talks about the work it's supposed to be doing, controlling crime. And then he says, and you must submit to that. You are not free to ignore the laws that the state passes. You aren't free to drive down the motorway at 80 miles an hour because you know that you're a good, safe driver. You're not authorized to ignore the regulations that the state brings in to create a stable society. You are to submit to the authorities, and you are to pay taxes to the authorities. You owe it to them, says Paul. This is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants. They give their full time to governing. They don't think of themselves as God's servants. I'm perfectly sure that the vast majority of our MPs do not think of themselves in any sense as God's servants. And yet they are, says Paul. They're doing his work whether they like it or not. In as far as they are restraining crime, and in as far as they are bringing about stability, then they are acting as God's servants. And they're to be honoured for that, and they are to be supported financially to do that work. Just as you support a pastor to do God's work in one way, you support your MPs to do God's work in a different area. They are God's servants too, though they don't know it. They're doing work that God has ordained. No government ever does that work perfectly. No government ever fulfills its responsibilities before God as it should do. And yet we're glad that they're there at all, fulfilling these ends at all. And we honour them and support them in that. And then the fourth thing I want to say is this. That churches and believers must resist the state when it exceeds its legitimate authority. When it starts exercising authority in areas where it has no right to exercise authority. Now, I can list for you three ways in which a state can exceed its authority. Three ways in which it can invade areas where it has no authority. First of all, when it issues commands that clash with God's commands. When it sets its own authority above God's authority. If the state says to us, "You are forbidden to evangelize. You are forbidden to talk about Christ. You're forbidden to name the name of God." Well, then the state has no right to say that. It has no authority to say that. That's exactly what the authorities in Jerusalem said to the apostles. They said, "You are forbidden to speak again in the name of Christ." And the apostles said, "We must obey God rather than men." They said, "We are not going to submit to the authorities in this. We're going to defy them and take the punishment if need be. But there is no way that we will accept that they have the authority to give such a command." The great issue in the first century for the early churches was whether believers should worship Caesar. The edict in every Roman province was that everyone must be prepared to worship Caesar. Everybody must be prepared to burn a pinch of incense in the shrine. Everybody must be prepared to say, "Caesar is Lord." That was the command. You will worship Caesar. And every believer knew, we must not worship Caesar. If the authorities make such a command, then they have no right, they have no authority to do so. And we are not to bow to their authority. In many places in the world, you could think perhaps most obviously of Nazi Germany. The command went out from the authorities that every citizen should be involved one way or another in the mass murder that was going on. If you knew that some Jewish family were being hidden in a home in your town, it was your legal duty to betray that family to the authorities in order that they should be put to death. Every citizen of that country, and indeed every citizen in every occupied country, was commanded to be involved in murder. Does the state have the right to do that? When God has said, "You shall not murder," and believers had to say, "No, the state has no right to command us to do something which God has forbidden. God has commanded us to care for the innocent, to protect the innocent. And that is what we will do. And if the state commands us to do something against God's law, we refuse. The state has no right. If the state says to believers in this country, you shall not smack children, then what must believers say? The believer says, God has already commanded. God has already spoken. God has already said that there are times when the rod must be used. A state has no right to overrule God's clear command. And again, at that point, we simply say, no, we do not submit to the state and its ungodly commands. The second occasion when a state will transgress, will trespass into an area where it has no authority, is when the state interferes in the life of the family. I am the head of my home. I am the head within my family. God has put me there. And God has put my wife and given her authority over our children, along with myself. That is God's structure. And there are things that we must decide for our family because God has authorized us and us alone to do it. He has given us authority to decide when our children should be disciplined. He has not given the state that authority. He has given us authority to decide how our children should be educated. He's not given the state that authority. You read through Proverbs and it's perfectly clear that God has given parents the right and the duty to decide how their children shall be trained and educated and brought up. Now, if the state begins to interfere and to tell me how I must deal with my children or how my marriage must work, then I have the right and sometimes the necessity to say to the state, to say to the authorities, you are out of order. You have no right to tell me what I do with my family. Imagine, I don't suppose it's happened very often, but imagine that the state took it upon itself to decide how often a man is allowed to kiss his wife. And they said, Ed, once a day and twice on Fridays. Now, there would be nothing in itself ungodly about the action that the state was requiring. It's not that that goes against any particular law of God. But the fact is that the state doesn't have the right to make such a law at all. It has no right to tell me how I must love my wife or how I must relate to my wife. It has no right to tell me how I must train my children. It has no right to tell me that that my children must learn to read and write. A parent may say, hey, before God, I believe it would be better for my children not to read and write. And a parent has the right to say it. The state has no right to interfere with the decisions that people make before God in bringing up their children. And then the third instance where a state will try to interfere and step beyond its authority is when the state interferes in the worship, in the ordinances of the church. Again, God has never given the state authority to tell us how we should worship him. God has laid down in the Bible who should make the decisions about the things that happen in the life of a church. He said that churches are to be ruled by elders, pastors. He says that there should be deacons to administer the financial affairs of the church. He said that on some things the whole church together will make decisions. But the one thing he has never said is that the state, the secular state, has the right to dictate what goes on in the life, in the worship of the church. So, if the authorities were to pass a law to say no church service must continue for more than an hour, no preacher must continue for more than 30 minutes, then we would say you have no right to pass such a law, and we have no duty to obey it. You say, well, that would never happen, would it? Well, of course it could happen. There have been, if you were with us when we were talking about Obadiah Holmes a little while back, then you'll be well aware of the fact that the state has taken it upon itself in this country to lay down exactly what prayers can and can't be said in churches, exactly what order of service must be followed. It has no right to do so. How can godless people sitting in Parliament take it upon itself to say this is the way God should be worshipped? The Westminster Confession sums it up very well in a chapter entitled Of Christian Liberty and Liberty of Conscience. God alone is Lord of the conscience, and hath left it free from the doctrines and commandments of men which are in anything contrary to his word, or beside it, if matters of faith or worship. If the government tries to tell us what we should believe or how we should worship, then it is stepping over the mark. It is stepping outside its God-given sphere of authority. And we must reject its claims to authority. We hold a Remembrance Day service here every on the Sunday nearest to November the 11th each year. And in that service we remember the dead of two world wars. Do you know why we do it? We do it because the government has never told us to. But if the government told us that we had to hold such a service, immediately I would say we will never hold one again. Because the government has no right. It has no right to tell us how we shall worship God on any particular Sunday. We need to be clear. God has given the government its sphere of authority. It is to govern society. It is to govern the way in which families interact with other families and with their neighbours. It is to govern the way that citizens interact with each other. But it has no right to pass laws that are against God's laws. It has no right to interfere in the life of the family. And it has no right to govern the worship and the ordinances within the local church. There has been a notorious case not very long ago where a particular woman was put under discipline. She had been a minister of a large denomination, and she was put under discipline by that denomination, and she was stripped of her position as a minister. So what did she do? She appealed to a tribunal. And the authority said she must be reinstated. Well, the government has no right to tell us how we should discipline one another. The state has no right to tell us that it has decided that we must revoke some discipline that we have put in place. Church alone has the right to discipline its own members in matters concerning the life of the church. And now my fifth point. Churches and believers must work to influence government for good. We are to be interested in what goes on in our country. We are to be interested in what is happening in government. We are to be interested in what the state is doing, what the authorities are doing. And we are to be working to influence government, the authorities, for good. How do we do it? Firstly, I urge then, first of all, that requests, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceable and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. We are to influence the authorities for good by our prayers. We really believe that when Christians pray for those in authority, it makes a difference. Hard to believe that in our day, isn't it? It's hard to believe that the hardened, rebellious, anti-God people who seem to dominate the political system, it's hard to believe that praying for them would make any difference. But Paul says it does. In his day, remember, Nero sat on the throne of the empire. And yet Paul could say, pray for kings, because your prayers will make a difference. We will live peaceable and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness if God influences those rulers in common grace and restrains their folly and gives them wisdom. So pray for them. Secondly, we influence them by our witness. As you read through the book of Acts, you see how often Christians had the opportunity to speak to people in authority, and they took it. They took it unashamedly. They took it boldly. And the whole of Acts chapters 22 to 26 is the account of Paul's witness to different people in authority, to Roman governors, to kings, to military authorities, to local government officials. Paul is taking every opportunity to speak to them, not just on legal issues, but he's reminding them again and again that they are answerable to God, that there is a God in heaven, that he has his laws, that he has his standards. He's pressing those things home to the authorities. When you're writing to your MP or whatever on some particular issue, there are those who would counsel you and say, look, don't mention the fact that you're a Christian. Don't mention the fact that you're saying these things out of Christian conviction. Just present yourself as somebody completely neutral. That'll be more effective. Well, maybe it would, but it's not what I see in the book of Acts. As if Paul, when he's defending himself, is going to say, now I am concerned here only with issues of general social policy. Not at all. He's going to make it clear at every point that he's driven by the thought of God and of God's reality. We are to be God's witnesses to the authorities. Thirdly, we are to influence the authorities for good by our prayers, by our witness, and thirdly, by our protests, and at times by our refusal to cooperate. Paul is on trial before the Sanhedrin, and Paul says this: my brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all conscience to this day. And then the president of the court ordered those standing near to Paul to strike him in the mouth. Here's Paul, a defendant in a criminal case, and the chairman of the court orders a soldier to thump him in the face. It's completely illegal. It's completely contrary to principles of justice. What does Paul say? Nothing? No, Paul says, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. Paul protests. He says, you are acting illegally. You're violating the law. Now, as it happened, the particular man who gave that illegal order was the high priest. And Paul afterwards said, well, I would have moderated my language if I had known that. Because I do owe a special respect to the high priest. But the fact is, Paul still believed it was right to make that protest. Not to just let the authorities get away with what they did. There were times when Paul carried through a policy of non-cooperation with the authorities. The most marked example is in in Acts and chapter 16, when Paul is in Philippi. And he's arrested as a result of a disturbance in the street, dragged before the magistrates, and the magistrates ordered Paul and Silas to be stripped and beaten. And they were severely flogged, and then they were thrown into prison. And the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. Well, you know what happened. You know that was the night of the great earthquake that broke their chains open. But what happened in the morning? This is the bit that I found interesting. When it was daylight, the magistrates sent their officers to the jailer with the order, release those men. Just let them go now. I think they've learned their lesson. They've had a good flogging. They spend a night in the cells. Let them go. And the jailer told Paul, the magistrates have ordered that you and Silas be released. Now you can leave. Go in peace. Then Paul said to the officers, they beat us publicly without a trial. Even though we're Roman citizens, they threw us into prison. And now do they want to get rid of us quietly? No way, says Paul. Let them come themselves and escort us out. Paul holds a sit-down strike in the prison. He says, I am not leaving this prison until the magistrates come here themselves, apologize, admit that they had no right to do what they're doing, and until they escort us out. And the officers went back and reported this to the magistrates. And when they heard that Paul and Silas were Roman citizens, they were alarmed. Because they had acted illegally. And they came to appease them. And escorted them from the prison. Requesting them to leave the city. And so all the citizens of Philippi see the magistrates with an egg on their faces. Having to go down to the prison and having to kowtow to Paul and Silas. Having to escort them as a guard of honour out of the prison. Paul insists that he's not going to leave without a fuss. He's not going to leave without a public apology. He is not going to cooperate with what the authorities are asking him to do. There are times when it's right to act in that way. We are to work to influence government for good by our prayers, by our witness, by our protest, sometimes by our refusal to cooperate. And finally, I'm going to ask a question rather than make a statement. Maybe at times, by our active attempts to overthrow a government. That is something which believers have debated all down through the centuries. Are there ever times when we should rebel against a government and seek to overthrow it? And believers have disagreed about that. The question really is this. Paul tells us that a government is there to punish wrongdoers and to reward people who do right. And Paul tells us that rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. But what happens when a government becomes so violent or so wicked that it actually rewards those who do wrong and punishes those who do right? What happens when a government reaches the stage where It holds terror for those who do right, rather than for those who do wrong. What happens when a government stops becoming a government? What happens when it simply becomes an oppressive group of thugs? When it makes war on its own people? I hope that if I'd been in Nazi Germany in the 1940s, as the Holocaust became evident, I hope that I would have joined the people who were working within Germany to overthrow the government. I hope I'd have had the courage to do what some Christians did then, to say, by any means now, we must remove this wicked man who is leading this nation. Because not to do so would have been to condone the continuing mass murder, to allow that government to stay in place without fighting actively against it, would have been to condone the murder of every one of those innocent people who were being dragged away to the gas chambers. I feel I would have shared in the guilt of that if I had not been willing to join in attempts to overthrow that government from within. Perhaps I feel the same way about what's been happening in Zimbabwe in recent years. I wish it had been possible for citizens, including believers, to say we cannot condone the mass murder that's happening all around us. We cannot stand by and allow the innocent to be slaughtered. And if the only way of ending this wickedness is by rebelling against our present government, we must do it. There are times in the Old Testament when a particular king of Israel had reached such a point of wickedness that it was right for the citizens to remove him and to execute him. Puritans in the 17th century reached the stage where they said, the king who is on the throne is such a wicked man, and he is abusing his power so greatly that he has become a traitor against the nation, and he must be brought to justice. He must be executed. That is something I would want you to consider for yourself, to search the scriptures for yourselves, to see whether you believe that that could be justified. My own conviction is that there are times when it is the lesser of two evils. It's never a good thing to overthrow government, but there are times, I believe, when it's the necessary thing to do. We are to seek to influence the authorities for good by our prayers, by our witness, by our protests, at times by our refusal to cooperate. And my own conviction is there are times when we must work to overthrow a government.